Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the road, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind, in your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. Jay Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when live and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is MJ Network. And we've got a stupendous show today. It may be raining and cold outside, but this is going to really warm you up. But before I start, I made a special promise to my beautiful niece, Katie Rose, who's going to be 18 on Thursday. And unfortunately, because of this horrific situation, she can't have a birthday party. But her aunt sent her something very, very special. So happy birthday, Katie Rose. And I'm so proud of you with your 4.0 GPR. And everything is going to work out. You know there's going to be a miracle and you'll have a graduation. Otherwise, your friends can come on my radio show and we'll have a graduation party that day. So this is going to be fantastic. Robert Chesterfield is an elegant magician with a dark past, deadly enemies, and a valuable new trick he's debuting in front of a packed theater. You can't believe this. Only for it to end with his death. In this case, is this a case of murder or just an ingenious illusion? To find out, author Philip Margolin is here with his best character. I love this girl, Robin Lockwood. Good morning. This is exciting. This book was really good. I read it in 2 hours. I couldn't put it down. Seriously.
Well, that's music to my ears. Any author loves to hear someone say that they read his book and couldn't put it down. So thank you for the compliment.
Well, unfortunately, my doctor is in the zone in New Rochelle and had his hands out for this book, and I said, Angelo, you're going to have to go and buy this one. I'm sorry, because I can't come there. I can't even go there, ever, until this is over. So tell us about Robin Lockwood and her journey to becoming a partner in the law firm.
Well, Robin is one of my favorite characters. A Reasonable Doubt is the third book in a series that I started when I started with St. Martin's Press, and they wanted me to do a series. And about half my books are series, half are standalones. And I was trying to think of a really interesting character. So Robin's background is unique. When she was in high school in a small Midwestern town, all of her brothers, she has three older brothers, wrestled for the high school, and she wanted to wrestle because she grew up with a wrestling family, but the school board said that she couldn't be on a boys' team. So Robin's dad, who was very supportive, sued the school board, and they got a lawyer, and the lawyer won the case for her so she could wrestle on the team, and she became the first girl to ever place in the district wrestling tournament, boys tournament. So that inspired her to be a lawyer. And when she went to college, the school she went to had a Division I wrestling team, and she knew it was impossible for her to qualify for that. But there was a gym nearby where they did mixed martial arts. And she started fighting in mixed martial arts matches and became a professional. And after she graduated college, she was accepted Yale Law School, which is one of the two or three best law schools in the United States. And to pay her tuition, she fought on television in pay-per-view events in Las Vegas. But and she got up to number nine ranking in the whole United States. But in her first year in law school, she got suffered a really brutal knockout and decided it would be better to spend her time fighting with her law professors than getting her getting short-term memory loss. So that's her background. And in the first book in the series, The Third Victim, she gets her dream job, which is being hired by Regina Barrister, the most brilliant criminal defense mm-hmm. lawyer in the state of Oregon. And Regina's called the sorceress because she wins impossible cases strictly because she's so brilliant. And in the first book in the series, Robin is thrilled to work with Regina on a death penalty murder case, but she starts to realize Regina may have the onset, early onset dementia. So, so at the end of that book, Regina has to retire from the practice of law, but she makes Robin a partner in her firm. And when the reasonable doubt starts, and Robert Chesterfield, who Regina represented 20 years before the main action in the book starts, comes in. He's a famous magician who wants to have Robin patent, get a patent for the Chamber of Death, which is a his greatest stage illusion. Mm. And he comes asking for Regina, but Robin explains, A, that Regina's retired, and B, that she doesn't do that type of law. But she gets curious and asks Regina, you know, if she remembers this case, and she does. And it turns out Regina represented Chesterfield 20 years before in a double murder. So that's sort of the setup for A Reasonable Doubt, and that's a little bit of how Robin became a brilliant lawyer and B, a mixed martial arts professional.
Well, what got me was that first scene, that prologue. Oh my God, you created the prologue, and then he snaps his fingers and he disappears. So what is real and what do we visualize and perceive, and what was her reaction to the illusion? She wasn't sure if it was real or not. That scared me, let me tell you. That prologue.
Well, I had more fun writing this book than I have with a lot of my other books. I have always have fun writing the book, but this one is sort of special. Mm-hmm. In 1970, I think it was ABC, had a late night show that had very unusual events on. They had a poker championship one week, the first full contact karate championship the next, and one night they had magic. And I had never seen a big magic show before. And I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. The one I remember that just blew me away was a woman sat on a bare stage on a bridge chair with just a sheet over her. And the magician pulled the sheet off, and she was gone, and she appeared in a cabinet on the other side of the stage. So that hooked me on magic. And I thought, boy, it would be great to have a big stage magician like David Copperfield as mm-hmm. one of the main characters in a book. And the thing that I had the most fun with, I don't know how these big illusions work. I mean, David Copperfield made the Statue of Liberty disappear. How do you do that? But fortunately, Marshall Amaton is a friend of mine. He's a judge, and he's an amateur magician. And he and Robert Cavazzi, who's a lawyer and a magician, showed me how to do the Chamber of Death illusion, where Chesterfield is locked in a sarcophagus, and poisonous snakes and scorpions are put inside, and you hear him screaming, "The trick's not working, let me out, let me out," and then he screams, and supposedly when you open up the coffin, he's gone, and then he reappears in the back of the audience. But in A Reasonable Doubt, when they open the coffin, Chesterfield's been murdered. And that was the second thing that was fun to me, figuring out how to murder somebody on stage in front of 3,000 people,
mm-hmm.
and you don't know who the killer is.
That is so scary. So Robert Chesterfield sought out Robin because he wanted to do something. He had messed his wealth, but he wanted her to patent his trick, his magician trick, his whatever he has created, his illusion. And then she goes and she wants to talk to Regina Barrister, and then that's how she finds out more about him. So can you actually patent an illusion? I don't think so. Well, can you?
Well, you can, and that was another thing I had to find out.
I got
this idea that, you know, Chesterfield would come to her. They asked her to patent it. So there are people that I know who are intellectual property lawyers, and you can patent a magic trick, but there's a problem.
Mm.
When you file your patent application for a light bulb or an automobile, you know, maybe an electric automobile or whatever, you've got to show how your gizmo works. And so the problem is you can't get a patent for a magic illusion, but when you get the patent, you would have to reveal exactly how the trick works.
Ooh.
So it's really not a smart thing to do if you want to be mysterious.
That is scary. But then we know somebody that we'll see. So who is Sam Mosia, and why does he want Chesterfield expelled from his exclusive club that his wife belongs to? Because his wife is kind of not too smart, but she's kind of rich.
Well, Samuel Mosier is the general manager of the Westmont Country Club, the most exclusive country club in Oregon. It's a fictional country club that's in several of my books. And what's happened is Mosier has been, Chesterfield is British, and he moved to Oregon and seduced his wife, who was the heiress to a fortune, and who isn't too sharp. And her husband many years passed away from a heart attack, and Chesterfield jumped in and was able to get her, trick her into marriage, but and then get Chesterfield into the country club. Well, what happens is Mosier is getting complaints from staff and the wives of other members that Chesterfield is making sexual advances to him, and then he's also cheating cards. He's an expert card cheat, but a number of the bridge players and poker players at the club have been refusing to play with him because they think he cheats. And so Mosier, this is how all the mystery starts 20 years before. Mosier demands that he change his ways, or he says, I'm going to see that you're kicked out of the club. And that starts a chain of events that leads to the murder of the attempted murder of Mosier by poison and the murder of his secretary.
That's so scary. But he's got assistants. So they won't reveal how the trick works. And his wife is, his ex-wife is cold and dispassionate, and she wants to know what happened, but she's more concerned about the money and her boyfriend. I don't like her at all, Claire, really. So how come, you know, really, oh my God, I really hated her, which is probably, you know, good, because I really didn't like her. And at this point I was saying, well, who cares if she gets what she wants? But the point of the matter is that, I mean, what happened, why won't his assistants, they were so loyal to him. And yet when they wanted to know what happened, they wouldn't tell. And of course you're not going to tell. And what about the wife? Tell us about her. I don't like that girl at all.
Well, first of all, the assistants sign a agreement when they work on a magic trick, a non-disclosure agreement. So if they were to tell anyone how the trick works, they could be sued. So they're afraid to do that, you know, to tell the police or anyone how this trick works, because they're afraid that they'll, you know, be sued for money. But in a murder mystery, you have to have a lot of suspects. And Chesterfield's wife hates him. and she's wealthy, and he had money, but he lost a lot of it, and so really, she has more money than he does. So if there's a divorce, she's gonna lose money. Plus, she's married. Her boyfriend is a very famous magician who hates Chesterfield because Chesterfield had a TV show where he revealed the David Turner's big illusion that he closes his Las Vegas show with. So when Chesterfield is murdered in front of 3,000 people, I have a whole bunch of suspects in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
The magician who hates him, his wife who hates him, gangsters who he owes money to, and a whole bunch more. And so when you're writing a murder mystery, you have to have a bunch of suspects who might have done the murder.
Now, the guy that I really didn't like, besides the ex-wife, is the DA. Oh, my God. He just wanted to arrest him. He just wanted to get it done because he didn't care. Which reminds me of a lot of different DAs that say, well, I've got this guy. I'm not going to look further. That's about it. So tell us about Peter Ragland and why he wants to arrest Chesterfield. Poor Chesterfield. It's like he's on a private quest to take him down. And there's other people involved. How come? I didn't like him at all. And I imagine you're going to bring him back again.
Not necessarily. Actually, my next book in the series is back in New York being edited, and Ragland's not in it.
Good.
But Peter Ragland, it's 20 years before when Robert Chesterfield was prosecuted for the poisoning at the Westmont Club. He hired Regina Barrister to represent him. And the deputy district attorney who was prosecuting the case was Peter Ragland. Ragland is a sort of a pathetic character. His father was one of the most famous and most brilliant attorneys in Oregon, and he's not. He basically got his job at the DA's office through his father's pull, and he's always tried to prove that he's just as good as his dad, but he's really not very smart. And when he goes up against Regina, she humiliates him. And so 20 years later, through a coincidence, he's in the theater when the murder of Chesterfield takes place. And he jumps in to become the lawyer or the DA on the spot in the hope that he can revive his career, which has gone downhill after he lost the first case to Regina, that now with this new murder case, which will be getting national publicity, he's hoping that he can revive his career by finding out who did the murder and then winning a conviction.
This was so outrageous. I mean, really, he just definitely thought that he was going to get a conviction, and he didn't care how. But this is so amazing how you see, right in front of you, the trick is done, and then you open it up, and the guy's dead. That was like, oh, my God. So very cleverly figured out that David Turner, who is the ex-wife's boyfriend, was arrested. So, and how to come he was arrested? How did they finally figure out that maybe he did something wrong? And then who were the two detectives that were handling this case? I wasn't sure if I liked them either.
The detectives are Carrie Anders and Roger Dillon. And this is a series. And Carrie and Roger are an interesting pair of detectives who are in all three of the Robin Lockwood books. The first one, they're introduced in the first book, the third victim, and then there's the second book, A Perfect Alibi. They're an odd couple. Roger is an African-American who's much older than Carrie. His nickname is OED, which is Oxford English Dictionary, because he's so smart that everyone has incredible respect for his intelligence. And he's real low-key, but very determined. Carrie is much younger than him. She was a detective in a small town in Oregon in the third originally, and she's about 200 plus pounds. She's over 6 foot. She's really strong, and she looks like she's not very bright because she talks slowly. And she sort of lumbers around, but she was a math major in college. So one thing that Roger and Carrie both have in common is they're really, really smart. And Carrie, during the series, starting with the third victim and going through the reasonable doubt, develops a good relationship with Robin. So every once in a while when they're working, Carrie's working to try to find out who a murderer is, and Robin's involved in the case. They will meet secretly and discuss stuff off the record that maybe they shouldn't, but they trust each other and have a lot of respect. Robin and Carrie have a lot of respect for each other, and they have this really good relationship that develops during the series.
I know. Those two I like. Tell us about Tamara Robinson, and I'll link to the case. And as we said before, Raglan just wants to win. He doesn't care how he does it. So who is Tamara Robinson?
Well, she just really has a very small part in the book.
She's
a police woman who's on the scene with another policeman because the reason Raglan is in the theater is to arrest Chesterfield, and on a small charge, but Raglan brings Tamara and this other police officer, and the whole idea is that after the show they're going to arrest Chesterfield for this minor crime, but when the murder occurs, Raglan takes over, and Tamara is the police officer who sort of organizes keeping everybody in the theater, all the witnesses, etc.
This was so interesting, though. Now, Lily, she's dead, poor thing. And how do her children? Poor Lily. I felt so bad for her. She didn't see this. She didn't see it straight at all. She's like blindsided by everything, and she actually believed what everybody told her. Scary. What about her children? How did they fit in when she found she's dead? They only wanted to care about money. They didn't really care about that she was dead, basically.
Well, Lily Dowd is the woman that Chesterfield tricks into marriage. And her children hate Chesterfield because they think rightly so, that he's a gold digger. They know he was just after money. And Lily at some point dies. You don't know if it's a murder or an accident.
Mm-hmm.
And they are just furious and demand that the district attorney, Chesterfield be arrested for murder. But again, like I said, there's not enough evidence that he actually murdered his wife, although you suspect he might have.
Well, scary. He really, you know, he was not very nice to her, and he did bad things. What can I tell you? He had a little fun on the side. Oh, well. So, this is the part that I really love, too. My mom had Alzheimer's. So, like Regina, there were times where she was actually lucid and remembered things, unfortunately, too well. She would remind me of stuff that I really didn't want to be reminded of. And so she goes to her to talk to her about Robert Chesterfield. How did you create that scene? And why does Robin have to, she has to make sure that she understands. I mean, Alzheimer's is deadly. I know that. And you can be fine one minute, and the next minute my mother look at me like, who are you? Do I know you? I go like, probably not, but don't worry about it. You'll figure it out later. So how did you create that part? Because that was really interesting.
Well, again, there's two plot threads in the third victim, which is the first Robin Lockwood book. One is the murder, where Robin is and Regina are representing a senior partner in a law firm who the police think is a serial killer. So that's the mystery part. But the other part is this conflict that Robin has because she idolizes Regina Barrister. But as they work together, she begins to suspect that Regina has the onset of dementia. And, you know, she has a conflict. Do you tell the most brilliant lawyer and your idol that you think she's losing her mind and maybe get fired? Or do you keep your mouth shut and maybe your client will die because it's a death case? So I explored and did a lot of research and really explored the issues of Alzheimer's and dementia. And I actually went through it myself twice with my aunt and my mother-in-law, who both had full-blown dementia. So I saw it from beginning to end. But Regina is a fascinating character, and I wanted to bring her back because she's such a powerful individual. And so I got this idea of having this backstory early on in the book that shows Regina when she was younger and in full possession of her power. What happens is that Robin is approached by Chesterfield about the patent for the magic trick, but he then says that he wants to put her, she says, well, we really don't do that. And he says, well, if I give you a retainer, could you represent me if a different area of law came up? And she says, well, what area would that be? And he says, well, I don't want to tell you right now. Well, after he leaves, Robin asks the woman who used to be Regina's secretary and is the only person in the firm who's been there from the beginning about Chesterfield. And she says, oh, my God, he's the magician who was charged with murder. But I don't remember much about it because I was just a receptionist at the time. So Robin then drives out to visit Regina, and she's having a good day. And Robin at first isn't sure she's going to remember what she did for Chesterfield, but then she does, because she's lucid. As you said, sometimes people with Alzheimer's are completely out of it, but sometimes they're also lucid. And fortunately for the book, Regina is lucid enough to tell Robin all about this murder case, actually a double murder case, that occurred in 20 years before. So
well, I know that sometimes their long-term memory, they remember. It's the short-term memory that gives them the problem, too, with Alzheimer's.
Right, and so I felt like I could pull that off. And,
yeah, you
and
did.
It was just really this desire to bring back this really wonderful character in another book that prompted me to set up the backstory.
I'm glad you did, because I like Regina. She's really great. So, now we've got a not-nice person that tried to steal his trick and why. And it's a good thing I don't eat chocolate because I'm allergic to chocolate. So what is this? Yeah, seriously? When I heard that, I go like, wait a minute. It's a good thing I'm allergic to milk protein. I can't even have milk. I can't even have ice cream. That's how serious it is. But what's the significance of the chocolate? Oh, people, you better watch out if you get, you know, chocolate for a present. And what other which magician? Somebody wanted to steal his trick, and why? Not that I blame them, but oh well, too bad.
Well, the chocolate comes in because Samuel Mosier, who is instrumental in bringing Chesterfield's sexual advances and cheating at cards to the people on the board of directors of Westmont Club, gets a box of chocolate for Christmas, and he's on a diet, so he gives them to his secretary, who then eats one and dies. So the chocolates are the vehicle for for poisoning the first victim. That Chesterfield, he's charged with her murder. So what was the second question?
The second part of the question, who wanted to steal his, somebody wanted to steal his trick. They wanted to steal his trick.
Well,
they wanted
really
to know how it was done.
Yeah, he doesn't really
he wanted to know
trick.
The history, but he wanted to know what it was.
Right. He wants to, he hates Chesterfield because Chesterfield had a TV show where he revealed how magic is done. So all the magicians hate Chesterfield, not just David Turner. But one of the things he does on the television show is to show how Turner's big finale in his Las Vegas show is done, and that ruins Turner. It almost leads to him getting fired from his very lucrative position at a major Las Vegas casino. So Turner wants to find out how Chesterfield does the Chamber of Death so he can reveal it on the internet, on YouTube, to ruin Chesterfield's show. So it's basically for revenge.
Like two kids that want to get even with each other. So sad. But what can you do? So they ask questions of the assistants. They're not going to tell anybody because they have non-disclosure. One is looking that she might have a grudge against him. And then an ex-detective is killed. So tell us about Morris Quinlan and who is Arthur Gentry and Sophia Russell. There's a lot of people that come into play. And you don't know who did what, which is really good.
Yeah, I don't want to give away too many of the secrets in the book.
No, don't give them away because we don't want anybody to know.
Yeah, because one of the things I try to do in the book is, I love old-fashioned murder mysteries. When I was a kid, I read Ellery Queen, who is the king of the fair play mystery. And he wrote in, I think, the 30s and 40s, and all of his mysteries had clues. And if you figured them out, you could figure out who the killer was. So what I try to do in my books is usually they all have surprise endings, and usually you don't know who the killer is till the last chapter. But I wanted to set up this book not only to be a legal thriller, because there's a lot of courtroom maneuvering, but also to be like one of those old classic murder mysteries where somebody is murdered and there are a whole bunch of suspects who want the person dead, but you don't know which of them is the killer. So I sprinkle the book with gangsters who Chesterfield owes money to, Turner, who hates Chesterfield because of his stealing, revealing the trick, Chesterfield's wife, who's afraid that she's going to lose a lot of money if he's alive and divorces her. And so there are all these various suspects who may or may not have committed the murder.
That is so scary. I know. It's really... But Claire really was on a rampage, and no matter... Even if David Turner was arrested and did it, she would have defended him anyway. She didn't care. And she didn't want to marry him. She just wanted him around. That's all. That was my impression. She didn't care. She's not very nice, seriously.
Well, a lot of the people in the book aren't very nice. Some are nice, some are not nice. But
Robin's got
to figure out who the killer is in order to save her client, who is David Turner, the magician, the police think is the killer, because they figure you'd have to be a magician in order to figure out how to murder someone on stage in front of 3,000 people and not get caught. So he's the most likely suspect because he's a magician, and that's what magicians do.
So why did she, why did she take his case? I mean, she didn't really want to, but why did she take his case?
Well, I was a criminal defense lawyer for 25 years. And when I was a little kid, I read all the Perry Mason novels. This one, I was in elementary school, and I decided the only thing I ever wanted to do was try murder cases. And then when I got older, I was in the Peace Corps in Liberia, West Africa. for 2 years. And when I was there in the 60s, it was a horrible dictatorship, and there was no rule of law. Whatever the government, whatever the president wanted to do, he did. They would send secret police in the middle of the night to kidnap you if you said anything that they disagreed with. And you didn't have a right to remain silent, didn't have a right to have an attorney represent you. So that was where I formed my philosophical reason for being a defense attorney. So when you're a lawyer, a criminal defense lawyer, you don't necessarily have to like your client.
Yeah, I know.
What's really important is when somebody is charged with a crime, that they get the best defense possible to make sure that an innocent person isn't being sent to prison. Because there's nothing worse than having someone go to jail or go to prison for a crime they didn't commit. So in Robin's case, she's a very dedicated criminal defense lawyer who takes on cases not necessarily because she likes the person, but because she believes that a person who's charged with a crime should get the best defense. And in Turner's case, there's a good chance he didn't do it. So that adds to the reason for taking a case there. If you on TV, all of the defendants are always innocent. But in real life, most of the time the police arrest someone, they actually did what they're charged with. However, during the course of my 25-year career, I represented two people. I had about 30 murder cases. Two of the people I was hired to represent after they had been convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison, I was hired to do the appeal. And while I was doing the appeal, to my horror, I realized that these people had nothing to do with the crime they were convicted of. Mm. And it took me four years in each case to get them out of prison. I was able to successfully win the not guilty verdict in one case and get the other case just dismissed, and the guy got out of jail. But there's nothing, people think, oh, lawyers must love to have innocent clients. And it's actually just the reverse, because when you have someone who's innocent, the pressure on you is unbelievable, because if you mess up, an innocent person is going to be thrown into prison. So Robin takes this case, all of her cases, very seriously, but particularly a case where the person that she's representing might not have done the crime.
So before I forget, I don't want to forget, Monday, Alan Zandresky will be there with the interpreter. That was a very interesting book about a young man, Jewish man, that's forced to interrogate a Nazi war criminal so that he goes to the other side and defects. On the 31st, we have Dangerous Ground. On the 2nd of April, somebody that we all know and love, Andrea Kane, No Stone Unturned. On the 16th, a book that came to me by accident is called What Death Told Terrence. And it's a true story actually about the author, Derek McFadden. And he's got cerebral palsy. And the author, the character tells the story from the point of view of his life living with it. On the 20th, we have three authors, the Montague Murders. On the 22nd, we have Vincent Zandri, R.G. Belsky, and Charles Salzberg. We're going to talk about outrageous characters that do the craziest things. I decided that. I thought that would be hilarious. And on the 26th, none other than John Land and Jessica Fletcher on Murder of 12. And the book is based on Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None. I read the book in an hour or two. I don't know how, but I did yesterday. You know, with everybody staying home, this is great. What can I tell you? So, we have a few minutes. Tell us how Robin, being an MMA fighter, how that helped her in this particular book, and at the end, sort of.
Well, one of the reasons that I wanted to make her a professional fighter is that about half my books, maybe even a little bit more, have very strong women characters as the main character. There's Amanda Jaffe, who's with her father,
yeah, I remember
Frank
her.
Jaffe. they're in a series, one of my other series, and then Dana Cutler, who's in what I call my Washington trilogy, where executive privilege is in the White House, Supreme Justice is set in the Supreme Court, and capital murder set in the U.S. Senate. Dana is one of the main characters in those books. So I have these really strong women characters, but in real life, if a man and a woman were to fight, a man would have the edge just because they have upper body strength and usually have done some sort of, you know, maybe they wrestled or boxed or something. So I thought, well, if I make Robin a professional fighter, if she gets in a fight with a man, it will make sense if she actually wins. People won't say, well, that's ridiculous. That couldn't happen. But if she's a professional fighter, they say, oh, okay, I can buy that. And you have a duty to your reading audience to make, you know, make your characters realistic, not make it, you know, well, oh, God, that could never happen. It's so silly. So that's why I gave her the wrestling and MMA background, so that in the series she occasionally gets into fights with men and is able to win, but it's because, you know, the reader won't say, oh, this is nonsense. And so that was the reason that I gave her that MMA and wrestling background.
Well, I went, hooray, she beat him. Or didn't beat him. I was, like, thrilled, seriously, because it was girl power, people. Don't mess with us. it's
and
funny because I'm...
Guys in the...
I thought it was great.
Go ahead.
Personally, I thought it was great.
Well, and usually, I have situations in the books, usually the men don't know she's a professional fighter, and
yeah.
So they sort of assume that they're going to be able to beat her up really easily, and that gives her an extra edge.
That's why I really liked her. That's why I really thought she was cool. So let's get to one more thing that was really sad, sort of. The ending in this book could sever her relationship with Jeff, who I happen to like. That she worked hard to cement, but the Cavill killers devoted to taking so many people down. So, how did you teach Ragland a lesson that he probably doesn't want to come back in the next book, the poor thing? And
well,
seriously, we'll
oh, go
get
ahead.
To Jeff in a minute. And how would you define reasonable doubt?
Well, actually, so let me take business with Jeff. Jeff Hodges is Regina Barrister's investigator, and we meet him in The Third Victim when Robin becomes a member of Regina's law firm. And Jeff is a very handsome guy, but he's got scars and a limp because he was a Washington County police officer who was badly injured in a raid in a meth lab when the meth lab blew up. And in The Third Victim, Robin and Jeff start to become attracted to each other. And then in The Perfect Alibi, the second book, they fall in love. And so they have their boyfriend and girlfriend by the time A Reasonable Doubt starts.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that Robin is very headstrong. And a lot of times she puts herself in danger, sometimes unnecessarily, because she's so overconfident and so zealous in her, she wants to do the right thing. And sometimes she doesn't use common sense, and she throws herself into very dangerous situations. And Jeff, who's been through that, where he went into this meth lab and was almost killed, really worries about her and tries to explain that she's not a one-man army or one-woman army, and that she's got to learn to depend on other people and not just go off like a vigilante thinking that she can save the day by herself. So that puts a lot of stress on their relationship because Robin is very headstrong and she doesn't like anyone telling her what to do. And Jeff is very concerned that she's going to die or be seriously injured because of her disregard for her own safety. Raglan, you know, the reason he's not in the next book is because I really didn't like the character very much. I just wanted him to, you know, he's someone you really don't like very much. And he gets humiliated initially by Regina 20 years before, and then Robin humiliates him in this book by showing that Turner isn't a killer. But Reasonable Doubt's a very interesting concept, and it's something a lot of people who aren't attorneys don't really understand. When we broke free from the British, we had a really bad, the American colonists had a really bad idea of government. They had been living under a very oppressive, evil government at the hands of the British. And the British, you know, they would have these general warrants where they'd just come in and search your house for no reason. They treated the colonists very badly. So when we set up our legal system, and you could do different types of legal systems, but our legal system, because we distrusted government when we set it up, under our system, we presume that the government might have made a mistake. And so if a policeman arrests somebody and we get into court, there's a presumption of innocence. It's presumed that the person who was arrested didn't do the crime. And so then we have 12 jurors who don't know anything about the case listen to the explanation that the police put forward, that the district attorney puts forward. And it's the burden of proof is completely on the state. When I was trying cases, I used to tell the jury, do you understand that my client and I could go to a movie during this trial and just show up for the verdict because we don't have to cross-examine anyone. We don't have to put on evidence. The state has 100% of the burden of proving that my client did what they say he did, put up or shut up. And there's a very high standard of proof. So in a criminal case, the state has to convince the jurors beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did what they're charged with. And what that means is that you can have you listen to all the evidence, okay? And in your heart, emotionally, you feel the client's guilty. And intellectually, just taking emotion out of it, you analyze it and think the defendant's guilty. But if there is one single piece of evidence, and it's got to be evidence that was put in, you know, accepted by the judge and put in, but there's one piece of evidence that makes you stop and say, boy, I'm sure this guy did it, but I have a doubt about what he did, whether he did it because of this piece of evidence. And my doubt is reasonable. It's not some silliness like the Martians took over his mind or something. But maybe it's a single statement that a policeman says. Maybe it's a fingerprint. But there's this one single piece of evidence, and it makes you, as a juror, pause and say, boy, I know the guy did it, but this piece of evidence makes me doubt that he did it. And if you have a single reasonable doubt, you have to acquit, no matter how much you're convinced that the person did it. And where you see this difference is in the standard of proof in a civil case. O.J. Simpson was charged with a criminal charge of murder where there was a reasonable doubt standard. And he was acquitted because some of the jurors had, even though they might have thought he really did it, they had a reasonable doubt based on a couple of things that happened during the trial. But then when O.J. Simpson was sued, for wrongful death in the civil case, he was found to have committed the crime, the murders, and that's because the standard of proof in a civil case is preponderance of the evidence, which just means it's more likely than not. So if you think 51% of your I think 51% he did it, then you would find for the plaintiff in a civil case. But if that's all you had in a criminal case, you'd have to acquit. So that's a long-winded answer to your short question about what a reasonable doubt is.
No, that's interesting. I wanted to know that a lot for other reasons. So before we end, poor Jeff. I feel so bad for him. This put a strain on his relationship. Yeah, he was not happy with her, and I got a word at the end. I said, "Well, they're gonna dump her, or she's gonna dump him, or it's not gonna work out." But
don't
first,
worry about
Oh, okay, good. I feel much better now.
In the next book,
they
get there fine. I did break them up. So you can sleep tonight. You don't have to worry. Their relationship is just fine in the next book.
Oh, that makes me feel better. I have two more questions. Okay. So why did more question, actually. Why did the killer target poor Regina? And then we're going to talk about where we see these guys next.
Well, I'm not going to answer that question because I don't.
You can't. I didn't think you could, but.
No, I don't want to give away too much of the plot. It's a murder mystery. You never give away never tell who done it. So I'm not going to answer that question. And what was the other question?
Okay, where do you see Robin and Jeff next, and what's next for you, and where could everybody buy 20,000 copies of this book? Seriously.
Well, the books are, it's all over. It's a major release from St. Martin's, and you can get it in any bookstore. And you should go to bookstores, especially given this horrible situation.
Yeah.
Go to your local bookstore. You don't just have to, not just to buy my book, but to patronize the bookstores. With the economy the way it is, buying books to keep the bookstores afloat is really important. And then, of course, if you're staying at home a lot, reading a good book is a way a good way to pass the time. I've stocked up on a ton of books. When I go on a book tour, I always buy books at the bookstore that I'm at, and I've been in the middle of this book tour for Reasonable Doubt, so I've got a ton of books. And then, you can do it online with Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Any place that sells books will sell A Reasonable Doubt.
Well, I have to tell you, you have to see my chair. It's loaded with too many books. I had like 20, and I read like 5 over the weekend already. And I read some really good ones. In an Instant is really good. The new Harlan Coben book is really good. The Boy from the Woods is really different. Of course, Reasonable Doubt is one of my favorites. David Roosevelt's coming out with the K-Team. It's a brand new series. It's interesting. And then there's the 20 books on my chair. That's going to cause it to topple over, and I've got about 20 more that they said are coming. So, yeah, Barnes & Noble up here in Westchester is open for now. The Strand bookstore closed. I just got an email from them. So it's a sad situation, but you're right. Reading is great, and it's a great pastime, and it makes you forget everything. So I want to thank you a million times. Thank you so much. For those authors that are listening, and I know there are people listening, if you want to do an hour on my show next week, if you want to talk about your book, if you want to send me a book to read, I'll just add it to my pile. Phil, thank you so much. And stay healthy.
I always enjoy being on your show. It's sort of become a
Well, if you decide you want to join any one of my crazy panels, let me know. The next one, like I said, is going to be April 22nd, and we're going to talk about outrageous characters that are over the top and do things that you would never think to have anybody do. So there's Vincent Zandri, Charles Salzberg, and R.G. Belsky. It's going to be quite unique. That's just me. So thank you so much. Everybody have a great day. Stay safe, and bye.
So long.